Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It is officially autumn. The leaves will be changing color soon. You might be starting to think about planning some fall outings, corn mazes, hay rides, all of that. And since we're the public radio station for the Big Apple, we thought what better way to welcome the fall than with a crisp, juicy segment all about our namesake, apples. So listeners, call in now with your favorite apple recipes, your favorite places in the tri-state area for apple picking, or any questions you might have about apple picking or cooking with apples. The number is 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280. You can always hit us up on social media at @allofitwnyc, same for Insta and for Twitter. Joining me now with his apple expertise is food writer James Rich. He wrote the cookbook Apple Recipes from the Orchard, drawing on his family's long history as apple growers and cider makers. James, welcome back to All of It.
Thank you so much. Hello, Allison.
So your family has a generations-long relationship with apples. Could you share some of that history with us?
Yes, absolutely. So my family are from, as you might be able to tell from my accent, from England and down in the southwest of England, which is particularly well known for as being apple country. So we have really good conditions for growing apples here. And so down here, there are many, 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 many orchards, and my family have been working the land for about 600 years in total. And they've been kind of farmers and making things like cider, which in the UK is an alcoholic version of apple juice. And in the last 60 years or so, they've kind of the family's formulated a business, and they've been selling cider and apple juice at the local farm for the past 60 years. So, yeah, what my family don't know about apples is not worth knowing, I say.
So I'm curious, how has the pandemic affected the work you do and affected the apple business?
Yeah, sure. So it's quite interesting, really, because much of the business down here is obviously related to producing drink for restaurants, hotels, and the good old English pub. Mm-hmm. Which last year, when we had the lockdown, completely closed all of that, where there was no industry for hospitality, really, as obviously you've experienced in the United States as well. And so it really dried up, to use a pun. So it was quite challenging. But obviously, the apples still grow. You know, you can't stop Mother Nature. COVID didn't get in the way of that. And so there was a big glut of apples at the end of last year, which luckily, you know, farm workers and things were still permitted to work. So we were able to press juice and still create the product. And then as lockdown has eased this year, people thankfully have been heading back to the pub, heading back to restaurants in the masses and enjoying a nice pint of cider or an apple juice. So yeah, it's been tough, but we're getting back to it now.
All right. So let's do a little bit of running the numbers. There are more than 7,500 varieties of apples globally, 2,500 here in the States. Why so many?
Yeah, there's so many. And if I'm hoping you're not going to run a pop quiz and ask me to name every single one, because even I can't do that. Yeah, the reason there are so many is because of the way that apples propagate and produce new trees and new fruit. You can have I have an orchard at home that's about 80 years old. And there were about 20 different trees in that orchard. And when it was planted, they were very specific trees that were planted. However, new trees have kind of popped up as the years have gone on. And those trees are a mix between the different varieties in the orchard. So they've mixed together and they've created a brand new different variety that has characteristics from both parent trees. And because of that, And the fact that apples are so popular and they were, you know, taken around the world by the Romans and the various empires and as an easy, nutritious snack for troops and things like that. Because they're spread so widely, it's meant that we've had all of this mixing of the different apple varieties and it's ended up with, like you said, over 7,000 varieties, which is quite incredible, really.
My guest is James Rich, food writer and author of the cookbook Apple Recipes from the Orchard. Our phone lines are getting full, so let's take a few calls. Let's go to Scott, who's calling in on line one, calling from Westchester. Hi, Scott. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hi there, Allison. By the way, you were the best thing on MTV, and now you're the best thing on NYC, too.
Just made my day, my friend. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I'm delighted to hear your guest was involved with hard cider, because that's just about the only alcohol I really enjoy drinking. But I would like to ask if the guest knows anything about wine sap apples. And I know there's kind of two basic kinds. There's Stamen wine sap and wine sap. And I love apples in general, but to me, wine sap apples are like twice as good as any other apple. I've been obsessed with them for a long time, but they're so hard to find. And why can't they be grown everywhere? I think they're only grown maybe in New Jersey, New York, and somewhere out west. But I was wondering if you could tell us anything about wine sap apples, and is it one of his favorite apples? And what are his two or three favorite apples, if not wine sap?
Okay, James, we have a wine sapple app enthusiast.
Yeah.
So let's start there.
Okay, well, it sounds like you're the expert on the wine sap apples, to be honest, but I know what you mean. So my understanding is that they are a heritage variety, so slightly more difficult to grow than some of the standard commercial varieties that you find in the supermarkets. We were just talking about how many varieties there are, yet you go into the supermarkets and there's a selection of kind of 7 to 10. But what we're finding, and I'm really pleased that you brought this up, is that that people are getting more interested in these different heritage and more unusual varieties, and they're becoming more and more popular. We have the same thing over in England. There's many different varieties that don't keep as well, but they have beautiful like nutty notes and creamy juices and things like that. My understanding of wine sap is that it's not actually one I've come across in the UK. But my understanding of it is that it's a slightly more unusual variety, so it's not grown very widely. I'd be very keen to give it a taste because I haven't tasted one before. My favourite apples, we have one in the UK called a Bramley apple, which is kind of similar to maybe like a Granny Smith in the USA, but it instead of when you cook it with sugar and a little bit of water and some lemon juice, it really melts down into this beautiful creamy sauce, and we pop that in things like apple pies, and it's utterly delicious.
Thanks for calling in, Scott. Let's go to Dan, calling in from Brooklyn on line 3. Hi, Dan. Thanks for calling All of It.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for the call. Considering that you see your organic apples being sold for more, and I'm just wondering, are they really safer than the ones that are not touted as organic in the sense that the pesticides issue is not so big? Because I know it's a big issue with strawberries. And also, does it make any taste difference or any other difference that you might notice in addition to being the possible safety issue?
Where do you stand on organic apples, James?
I'm a big fan. I personally think that, yes, it does make a difference to the taste. When you use pesticides, and it's all about controlling the crop and ensuring that you get the absolute maximum yield for the for your per acre or per orchard. With organic, it's more expensive because you don't have that element of control, and so nature takes its course, and sometimes half your crop will be wiped out by a pest, or there might be a disease in it or whatever it is that would have been otherwise controlled by that pesticide. So there's a lot more work that goes into it, as well as things like you have to pay for certification and all of that. So I personally think that there is a big benefit. We don't spray any of our apples at home in the orchard that we've got at home. We keep them completely natural, which means that, yes, we get fewer apples every year. But in my mind, I prefer to not be consuming the pesticides and leaving it as natural as possible and exactly like nature intended.
Let's check in with Amelia, who's calling in from Staten Island on line two. Hi, Amelia. Thanks for calling All of It. You're on the air with James Rich.
Hi. How are you?
I am great.
Hey, James. Well, I had just called this to say that, you know. Well, every year we go to an apple fest, and it's a great time of the year, the fall, to do that. And we also go apple picking. There's a couple of places in Westchester, New Jersey. And we love making all kinds of things with apples, like apple cake. Apple cake is also a big thing during the Jewish holiday.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the items that they use. Well, they make during Rosh Hashanah, and I've made apple cake before and brought it into work. And I don't know if you know this, but apples have like 195 milligrams of potassium in them. And the one thing with apples is you could do so many things with apples.
You know, it's so true. I'm curious, James, about the health effects of apples. Amelia brought up an interesting point.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously there are lots of natural sugars in apples, which depending on what your how your health is, you might want to kind of monitor the consumption. But there, it's natural sugars rather than kind of refined and unnatural sugars, as well as potassium and a whole host of vitamins and crucial fibers and things like that. So they really are like, you know, they say an apple a day keeps the doctor away. And I think that's definitely true. I think that the more that we can encourage people, particularly young people and children, to reach for an apple instead of a confectionery, you know, some candy or anything like that, I think it's a great thing, because they certainly have many more health benefits than a chocolate bar or some candy.
James, I want you to follow up on this Twitter comment. Somebody wrote, we were up in the Buffalo, New York area last weekend and got apples from a cute little farm stand. Turned out to be the worst apples ever. Totally inedible. Is that a thing? Is it difficult to grow edible apples, let alone tasty ones? How is it done? How is this experience common?
Yeah, so what's likely happened there is that they picked up a cooking apple or a juicing apple. So the apples that we make hard cider with, both in the US and in the UK, they're very different type of apples. They're very, very full of tanning. They are quite acidic and dry. And if you bite into them, they're really not very tasty at all. They're not that juicy, beautiful apple that you expect it to be. And they can be quite small as well. But if you press them and you extract the juice, and then you bottle that and you add yeast and bottle it, you can create some really delicious hard ciders. And so they're great for juicing, not for eating. The apples you want for eating are generally a little bit bigger. They're obviously very juicy. But sometimes I can appreciate it can be very difficult to tell the difference. And it does take a bit of a trained eye if you're not familiar with them. But yeah, they've likely picked up a juicing apple rather than an eating apple.
My guest is James Rich, food writer and author of the book Apple Recipes from the Orchard. Listeners, we're taking your apple calls. We want to hear about your favorite recipes, your favorite orchards in the area to pick your own apples, or maybe you have any apple questions you might have for our aficionado, James Rich. The number is 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280. After the break, we have a question about reviving an apple orchard, and we'll ask James about some apple-based cocktails. This is All of It. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest this hour is James Rich, food writer and author of the cookbook Apple Recipes from the Orchard. A great conversation for the first full day of autumn. So, James, around here in this area, apple picking is a thing. People plan their whole weekends around it. They get Airbnbs and go apple picking. So I want to ask you a little bit of advice for picking apples. Can you tell the quality of the fruit from the bark or the leaves or the soil? Or is there something that we should keep in mind when we go apple picking?
Yeah, sure. So the best tip I can give for anybody who wants to go apple picking, which is obviously an amazing thing to do at this time of year, well, when the weather gets slightly crisp, you've got your knit on, your autumn knit, and you go out into the orchards, is to look for the apples on the tree that are, they look quite fairly big and they look like they might be juicy. And then when you go to pick them, you only have to basically touch them and they'll come off of the tree in your hand. If you have to pull them at all, then that means that they're not quite ready, they're not quite ripe, so they haven't finished filling with lovely juice. So it shouldn't be a struggle to pick it from the tree. They should fall into your hands very naturally. And then in terms of the types of trees that you need to look for, don't pick anything from anything that is too young. So if a tree is, any less than kind of 3 to 5 years old, it won't have very much fruit on it. And so you really need to let the fruit develop and let the develop fully. Mm-hmm. before you pick it. So you're best picking from the bigger, more mature, established trees before you're picking from any of the small ones.
Let's go to Jordan, who's calling in from Norfolk, Connecticut. Hi, Jordan. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hey, Allison. How are you? I'm one of these, crazy New Yorkers who bought a farm in the dark days of the pandemic and moved out of town. So I'm up in New England now. I'm loving it. It's a hobby farm. I've got a 2-acre apple orchard that looks like it hasn't been tended to between 10 and 20 years. There's probably 4 or 5 dead trees, but there's 6 still alive. The orchard is completely overrun by a native plant called goldenrod. And I picked one of the apples on the living trees last fall, and they were kind of small and they were super hard in texture, like they wouldn't be fun to eat, but they were sweet and delicious tasting. And I'm wondering how I should revive this orchard to get better fruit. Is there something I can do to make that orchard more productive and revive it?
Yeah, absolutely. So it sounds like we're actually in the same boat, because I did the same thing as you last year in the middle of the pandemic. I up sticks and left the city and moved back to the countryside and bought a house with my own orchard and have some established trees in there. My advice, certainly the first thing that I did when I went into the orchard is I took my dad for one, because he's a real expert. but is to, if they haven't been looked after, the trees, then they need to be pruned. So not quite now, because the fruit's on the trees, but leave it until January, February time, when it's really, really cold and frosty. All of the sap within the tree has gone down to the base and the trunk of the tree to protect itself. And you need to get in and you need to prune the tree to remove much of the overgrown branches. What that does is it means that when the tree comes back to life and you start to see foliage, it means that light and crucially oxygen and air can get in amongst the whole tree. And what that will mean is the tree will be able to protect itself from disease, but also it gives the apples more space to develop and grow properly. It also lets more light in so that they can obviously benefit from that. And generally they're not competing with so many other fruit. Another thing that you can do, again, it's probably a bit late to do this now, is to, when the apples start forming, and you've got a good understanding of kind of what the fruit's going to be on the tree around June time, is just to thin out any duplication. So you might see some apples that are kind of clumped together in 2, 3, or 4 clumps. Or just take them out so there's just one there, so that the tree can really put all of its energy and good stuff into producing the biggest and juiciest and most delicious apples. I think that will really help you as a first step. And then obviously have a look next year, see what the fruit's like, and then go from there. I hope that will help.
Good luck. Can't wait to hear. Let us know how it goes, okay? You can either send us pictures on Instagram. We'd love to check out your orchard once you get it up and running. Let's go to Kevin on line 2, calling in from my hometown of Glenridge, New Jersey. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Allison. I just wanted to give a caution to people who have apple trees in their backyard. I'm in charge of a small community garden in Glenridge, and 5 years ago we planted apple trees, And the other day, I noticed that there was a gooey substance on the bottom of the trunk, and it's just spongy, and it's unfortunately the lantern flies. So we're going to have to chop that one down. But I know apple trees are susceptible to lantern flies, so I just want people to know, check the bottom of your trunks.
Kevin, thank you for the heads up. That's interesting. James, when you think about protecting your apple trees, what are some of the things that you folks have had to do to make sure your trees stay safe and healthy?
Yeah, so I think a lot of the, certainly with young trees, sounds like they've had the issue there. The bark on the trees is very thin and very young and supple. So unfortunately, bugs and nasties and disease can get into it very easily. So I think, you know, do your due diligence, check on the tree very regularly. If you see anything coming, then do a little bit of research online and apply some additional protection to it. And that can be anything from a simple kind of, actually honey works really well, honey and water, which creates a nice antiseptic. If you're trying to be natural, obviously you can look at sprays and pesticides if that's what you want to do. I would advise not doing that. I would try going down the natural route first. Or even some light, very light soapy water to kind of clean some of the bark if you're noticing anything that's on there. You also need to protect the young trees from any animals. So I'm not sure what New York's like for wildlife. Certainly when I was there, I didn't see any deer or sheep roaming around. But if you live in an area that has any wildlife, then you need to ensure that you are fencing the tree off so that they can't get at the bark, because that's incredibly delicious for those types of animals. It's very young and fibrous for them. I would keep your due diligence and check on it and wash the tree if it needs it, and apply a little fence just to keep everything out.
James, your countrymen and women have come out in full force on Twitter and on the phone. Let's go to Allison, who is calling in from New Jersey. Hi, Allison. Thanks for calling All of It. You're on with James Rich.
Okay, thank you. I've got two quick questions. I'm British, but I've been living in New Jersey for 22 years, and my grandmother used to have an ancient Bramley tree, and I do miss Bramley apples. So my first question really is a priority. With access to only the stuff that comes into normal supermarkets, I wonder if anybody could recommend the best sort of apples for, you know, normal apple pies and that sort of thing.
Good apple pie apple. James, what do you think?
Yeah, so I have to completely agree with you. When I was very fortunate, and when I came in to see Alison last time, actually, in the studio, I was very fortunate to spend some time going around the U.S. looking at, because that's what I do, looking at supermarket shelves and the apple varieties on the shelves. And I was really sad not to see the Bramley apple, because, like I was saying before, it's such an institution in the U.K. and it provides a beautiful apple pie. So I completely hear you, and I would send you some over if I could. What I would say is that when I make an apple pie, if I don't have them, I try to use a variety of different apples. So I know Granny Smith is really popular over there, and that does make a nice apple pie. But also things like Gala's and Braeburn's and things like that. If you cook them enough, they will kind of break down a little bit. But unfortunately, I've not found anything quite yet that replicates that amazing apple pie with Bramley apples. Sorry about that.
We're having a lot of folks who are very interested in wine saps. Julia on Twitter said, wine saps are the new Honeycrisp. I remember when you couldn't find any Honeycrisps anywhere for the past few years. You could only find wine saps during small windows at random New York farmer markets. But last year, a Union Square vendor had them fully stocked for the entire season. And someone else wanted to know, Josh wanted to know, are Honeycrisp really worth the extra dollar or two a pound? What makes them so expensive? So that's sort of a two-parter. What makes one apple more expensive than the other, and where do you come down on the Honeycrisps?
I have to be honest. With things like Honeycrisp, the reason it's more expensive is because it's a brand. Those apples have been developed very specifically for the supermarket. They have, they're mass-produced, and so they've been bred you know, they're resistant to disease. They produce nice, big, juicy apples for eating. And so there's nothing wrong with them. But the reason they're more expensive is because they've had all of that kind of work that's gone into creating it. I mean, they're delicious. I think that, you know, they're such a nice big size. I really enjoyed them, and they're good in cooking and in cakes particularly. That's why they're quite expensive. And what was the first part of the question, sorry?
I think the first part was just weighing in on how you like the Honeycrisp. You answered, I think, both parts of the question. So, James, before I let you go, I think a lot of people here obviously have great recipes for apple cakes and pies. Obviously, apples are very big in New York. But I want to ask you about two recipes that are a little bit different. What is a good apple-based cocktail?
A good apple-based cocktail. Well, one of my favorites is actually similar to a Russian mule, they call it over here. I'm not sure if it's the same in the UK, which is vodka based with ginger and also a dash of apple juice as well, and then some apple skin peeled and put into the glass as well. So that's vodka, and there's also a dry martini that you want. Well, not so dry because it's quite sweet, but a martini that you can make, so gin and vodka, with apple rind and lemon juice as well, which is delicious.
And you have recipes that for some soups, some apple-based soup. What is your favorite?
I do. So one of my favorites at this, well, coming to this time of year, as it's getting colder, is a spiced parsnip and apple soup. So parsnips can be quite sweet in themselves, but if you add some nice spices, some nutmeg, and some cloves, and you know, plenty of seasoning, you can create a really delicious, warming, spicy parsnip and apple soup. I generally use a kind of a soft apple in those soups so that they break down fully, and you're getting a kind of like creaminess coming from it. That's something I really look forward to every year, and I actually throw a little bit of chili flakes on there as well to spice it up even more. That was delicious.
James Rich is a food writer and author of the cookbook Apple Recipes from the Orchard. You definitely got us in the fall mood today. James, thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me on again.